ते
वासुदेवाया
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाया Continue reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 1, The Activities of Maharaj Priyavrata. Text 5. It is in prose, and I will just read it again. Sri Shuka Uvacha, Madham Uttam Bhagavata, Uttama Shlokasya Srimach, Charanaravinda, Makaranda Rasa Avisheshita Chetaso Bhagavat Paramahamsa Daita Katam Kinchid Antaranya Vihatam Swam Shivatmanam Padavim Naprayena Inbanti. The translation again. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, "What you have said is correct. The glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is praised in eloquent transcendental verses by such exalted personalities as Brahma, are very pleasing to great devotees and liberated persons. One who is attached to the nectarian honey of the Lord's lotus feet and whose mind is always absorbed in his glories may sometimes be checked by some impediment, but he still never gives up the exalted position he has acquired." Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sri Shukadeva Goswami accepted both of the king's propositions, that a person who is advanced in Krishna consciousness cannot embrace materialistic life again, and that one who has embraced materialistic life cannot take up Krishna consciousness at any stage of his existence. Although accepting both these statements, Shukadeva, by saying that a person who has once absorbed his mind in the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead may sometimes be influenced by impediments, but he still does not give up his exalted devotional position. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, there are two kinds of impediments to devotional service. The first is an offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnav. This is called Vaishnav Aparad. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu warned his devotees not to commit Vaishnav Aparad, which he described as the mad elephant offense. When a mad elephant enters a beautiful garden, it destroys everything, leaving a barren field. Similarly, the power of Vaishnav Aparad is so great that even an advanced devotee becomes almost devoid of his spiritual assets if he commits it. Since Krishna consciousness is eternal, it cannot be destroyed altogether, but advancement may be checked for the time being. Thus, Vaishnav Aparad is one kind of impediment to devotional service. So we discussed Vaishnav Aparad yesterday, and there's one point that we should mention today. Of course, the general system is if one offends a Vaishnav, one should approach the offended Vaishnav and beg for forgiveness. And in general, the merciful Vaishnav will forgive one. If, however, the offense is so grievous that the Vaishnava is not pacified immediately by one's appeal, but it's not just an appeal for forgiveness, it should be a sincere sense of remorse accompanied by an appeal for forgiveness, then one should continue to try by any means and all means to please the Vaishnava and satisfy him. But if, in spite of all efforts to pacify the offended party, one still is unable to satisfy him or her, then one is enjoined to constantly chant the holy names of the Lord. Now, one of the effects of Vaishnava aparadha, one of the effects of offenses in general, and especially of Vaishnava, and because one uses one's, even though one makes the effort to chant, one doesn't get the same benefit. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur compares the position of such an offender to a person with a serious disease who cannot really digest food. Even though he eats, he doesn't get the nutrition, but still he has to eat. And somehow or other he'll get some benefit. He'll get enough to maintain his life, and then very slowly and gradually he'll start to recover, and then he'll be able to digest and assimilate his food more. So in the same way, if one has diminished one's taste for chanting by Vaishnavaparadha, and in spite of one's best efforts, the Vaishnava still is angry, then one simply must take shelter of the holy name. And by continuous chanting, in spite of one's lack of taste, in spite of the fact that one doesn't get the full benefit of the chanting, gradually one will get benefit, and one's spiritual health will be restored, and then one will be able to chant with taste again. So that is the first category of impediment. Now we come to the second category, after Vaishnavaparadha. Sometimes the Supreme Personality of Godhead or his devotee desires to impede. For example, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha were formerly Jai and Vijay, the gatekeepers in Vaikuntha. But by the desire of the Lord, they became his enemies for three lives. Thus, the desire of the Lord is another kind of impediment. But in both cases, the pure devotee, once advanced in Krishna consciousness, cannot be lost. Following the orders of his superiors, Swayambhuva Manu and Lord Brahma, Priyavrata accepted family life. But this did not mean he lost his position in devotional service. Krishna consciousness is perfect and eternal, and therefore it cannot be lost under any circumstances. Because the material world is full of obstructions to advancement in Krishna consciousness, there may appear to be many impediments. Yet Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, declares in Bhagavad Gita 9:31, Kaunteya Pratijanihi Name Bhakta Pranashyati. Once one has taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, he cannot be lost. In this verse, the word Shivatamam is very significant. Shivatamam means the most auspicious. The devotional path is so auspicious that a devotee cannot be lost under any circumstances. This is described in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita by the Lord Himself. Partha naiveha namutravinas tasya vidyate. My dear Arjuna, for a devotee there is no question of being lost, either in this life or in the next. Bhagavad Gita 6:40. In Bhagavad Gita 6:43, the Lord clearly explains how this is so. Tatratam buddhisam yogam labhate porvadehikam yatate cha tato bhuya sansido kuru nandana. I'll just read the translations of the two verses. 6:40 reads, O son of Pritha, a transcendentalist engaged in auspicious activities does not meet with destruction either in this world or in the spiritual world. One who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil. And text 43, well, text 41 and 42 describe that the yogi who's not completely successful in the present life will either take birth on a higher planet, or he will take birth on earth in a family of pious Brahmins, or yogis, or wealthy people. Suchinam Srimatam Gehe Yoga Brashta Bijayate. Then text 43, which Srila Prabhupada says in the purport, explains how it is so that one is never lost. On taking such a birth, he revives the divine consciousness of his previous life, and he again tries to make further progress in order to achieve complete success, O son of Kuru. In the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, or in the Nectar of Devotion, which is Srila Prabhupada's summary study of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Srila Prabhupada says that generally devotional service is a continuation from the past life. And especially if someone has a natural attraction to the process of devotional service, to hearing about Krishna and to chanting, it is understood that he has made progress in his past life, but that due to some offense, usually Vaishnava aparad, he could not be completely successful in devotional service in the previous life, and therefore he is continuing in the next life. And we see practically that different devotees have different degrees of aptitude for Krishna consciousness. And the ones that are naturally attracted, we understand, have made advancement from the past life. And devotees who are struggling more, they may have not been as advanced from the past life, or they may even be beginning for the first time. But the fact is that once one has begun the process, even if one's progress is interrupted by something like an offense, he or she still gets to continue, either in the same life or in the next life. And there are many instances in the scriptures and even in the lives of our contemporary devotees where the devotee's service has been interrupted, but within the very same life, before the time of death, they come back to their Krishna consciousness. By the order of the Lord, a perfect devotee sometimes comes to this material world like an ordinary human being. Now, I should comment on the word perfect, because there are degrees of perfection. If we take the verse, Manusyanam Sahasresu Kashchid Yatati Siddhaye, that out of so many thousands of men, one will seek perfection. And out of so many perfected beings, hardly one will know Krishna. So here, perfection means liberation. From the material point of view, one is perfected when he's liberated. But only a devotee can understand Krishna and be liberated, in the higher sense of liberation, which is to develop love of God. We find in the scriptures that one who chants in Namabhas is liberated. And we have the example of Ajamil. Ajamil is also an example of someone whose devotional service was interrupted but revived in the end. As you know, he happened to name his son Narayan, and at the advanced age of 88 years, his son was just a small child. So we can imagine how entangled he was in household life to have a small child at the age of 88 years. And then at the time of death, he called for his son, Narayan, not intending to chant the holy name of God, but just to call his son. But because he uttered the holy name without offense, in Namabhas, he was liberated. He was liberated from the hellish punishment that awaited him. He was liberated from the sinful reactions. And he was liberated from material attachment, because the wife to whom he was so attached and for whom he engaged in so many sinful activities, he left her, and he left his son Narayan to go to Haridwar and to perfect his devotional service. So he was liberated by Namabhas. He was liberated from material attachments, and he was liberated from sinful reactions, but he didn't achieve love of God by namabhas. One achieves love of God by shudana, by pure chanting. So he left his wife and son and home and went to Haridwar and continued chanting. And then when he was perfect in chanting, he was, and developed love of God, he was eligible to be taken to Vaikuntha Loka. So when, just coming back to this statement, by the order of the Lord, a perfect devotee sometimes comes to this material world like an ordinary human being, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's coming from Krishna Loka. Of course, someone may. That's like a different category of Shaktivesh avatar. But I'll read on and then you get the idea. By the order of the Lord, a perfect devotee sometimes comes to this material world like an ordinary human being. Because of his previous practice, such a perfect devotee naturally becomes attached to devotional service, apparently without cause. Despite all kinds of impediments due to surrounding circumstances, he automatically perseveres in devotional service and gradually advances until he once again becomes perfect. Bilva Mangala Thakur had been an advanced devotee in his previous life, but in his next life he became greatly fallen and was attached to a prostitute. Suddenly, however, his entire behavior was changed by the words of the very same prostitute who had so much attracted him, and he became a great devotee. In the lives of exalted devotees, there are many such instances, proving that once one has taken to the shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, he cannot be lost. Kauntiya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashiti. So, coming back to the point of different degrees of perfection, liberation occurs somewhere. Of course, we say that a devotee is automatically liberated, and that's true. But learned authorities like Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur have analyzed the different degrees of liberation, because as one progresses in devotional service, he becomes more and more liberated. In the beginning, you know, we chant, we follow the regulative principles, but we still may be quite attached to the material world. Even then, we can be considered liberated because we're engaged in the process of liberation. But practically, we're still quite attached, and as we progress in devotional service, we become more attached to the holy name of Krishna and less attached to the material body and expansions and of the material body. And about at the stage of ruchi, one is like the stage of Ruchi, one is more attracted to Krishna consciousness than to Maya. So, all the way up to a Shakti, there's these different stages, Adoshadha, Tata, Sadhu, Sangha, Tata, Bhajana, Kriya. One is engage in sadhana bhakti. And then there's another division called sadhya. Sadhana is like the means and sadhya is the goal. And generally, there are the two divisions, sadhana and sadhya. But Srila Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu divides sadhya into two divisions, bhava bhakti and prema bhakti. They are both liberated platform. They are both the stage at which one has direct realization of Krishna and revelation of one's eternal spiritual form and one's eternal service to Krishna. And prema bhakti is just a more condensed form of bhava bhakti. So Bhogamangal Thakur was considered to have been in the stage of bhava bhakti. It's liberated. It is love of God. Prabhupada translates it as ecstatic love of God. And prema bhakti, Prabhupada translates as pure love of God. But to really enter the Vaikuntha realm, one should have achieved prema bhakti, which happens automatically. When one comes to bhava bhakti, he doesn't do sadhana. It's just a natural process of bhava bhakti maturing and becoming prema bhakti. So Bhogamangal Thakur was an advanced devotee. He had reached the stage of bhava bhakti, but still somehow or other he became attracted to a prostitute. And you may know the story that one night it was storming and there was thunder and lightning and torrential rains, and the river was flowing swiftly and overflowing, and you know, Bhogamangal Thakur had the desire to meet the prostitute that night, so he, you know, he went out in the storm and tried to cross the river, and in the river there was a dead body floating, and he sort of caught hold of the dead body to get support to cross the river. And then he came to the prostitute's house, and there was a wall around the compound that was locked, and he had to, you know, scale the wall, and you know, he really went through a big ordeal to get to her. And when he got to her and, you know, told her what he had gone through to reach her, she said to him that if you had as much attachment for Krishna as you have for me, you would be much better off. So you should rather just go to Vrindavan and find Krishna. Now those words of the prostitute somehow reawakened his Krishna consciousness from his previous life. And just hearing those words, you know, he left the prostitute and he was so determined to go to Krishna that he would not allow anything to impede his progress. And somehow he did have that weakness for women. So anyway, on the way, he started to follow a young lady, a Brahmani, and because of the culture, she, when they reached her home, she invited him in, and her husband was there, and so they said, how can we serve you? Because he was a Brahmin, but actually he was attracted to her in a lusty way, and so then he said, yes, you can please give me your hairpins. And then with her hairpins he poked out his eyes, because he felt that because of his eyes he was becoming attracted to the flesh of the body, the female form, and it was getting in the way of his Krishna consciousness. So he was so determined. And it all just came apparently from those few words spoken by the prostitute. But what had actually happened was that his previous consciousness was revived. And then as he was trying to make his way to Vrindavan as a blind man, a young boy came and, took his hand and was accompanying him. And the young boy was Krishna. And then when they got to the precincts of Vrindavan, Krishna said, I've brought you to Vrindavan, now I have to go. And Krishna was trying to pull his hand out of Bilva Mangal Thakur's hand. And Bilva Mangal Thakur was resisting. He didn't want to let him go. But eventually Krishna took his hand out, and then Bilva Mangal said, well, you can take your hand out of mine, but you can't take yourself out of my heart. And then, he became Bilva Mangal Thakur, the great Krishna Karnamrita, great devotee. Of course, the prostitute was a devotee. That was just the culture, that there were prostitutes, and some of them were devotees, but they were just prostitutes by occupation. And then some authorities comment that Bilva Mangal Thakur's spiritual master from his previous life entered the heart of the prostitute and spoke through the mouth of the prostitute. So suddenly, his entire behavior was changed by the words of the very prostitute who had so much attracted him, and he became a great devotee. In the lives of exalted devotees, there are many such instances proving that once one has taken to the shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, he cannot be lost. Kuntiya pratijanihi name bhakta prinashiti. So another example is Bharat Maharaj, who we discussed the other day, and Ajanya. The fact is, however, that one becomes a devotee when he is completely freed from all reactions to sinful life. As Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita 7:28, Yesham tvantagatam papam jananam punyakarmanam te dvandamoha nirmukta bhajante mam jadavritaha. Persons who have acted piously in previous lives and in this life, whose sinful actions are completely eradicated, and who are freed from the duality of illusion, engage themselves in my service with determination. On the other hand, as Prahlad Maharaj said, Matirna Krishne Parata Swatova Mito Bipadyeta Grihavratana. A person who is too attached to materialistic family life, home, family, wife, children, and so on, cannot develop Krishna consciousness. So now Srila Prabhupada is bringing us back to the original paradox that if someone is attached to material life, he cannot take to Krishna consciousness. So, how could Maharaj Priyavrata or any attached person like ourselves take to Krishna consciousness? And on the other hand, one who is a devotee is understood to be completely pious and free from sinful actions and reactions. So how could he fall down into sinful activities? These apparent contradictions are resolved in the life of a devotee by the grace of the Supreme Lord. And therefore, a devotee is never bereft of his position on the path of liberation, which is described in this verse as Shivatamam Padavim. So again, we come back to the resolution of the mystery, which is the mercy of the devotee. In rare cases, it may be the mercy of the Lord directly, but in most cases, it's the mercy of the devotee. And in the transcendental relationship between the Lord and the devotee, the Lord always likes to fulfill the desire of the devotee. So if the devotee wants to deliver some soul and gives mercy to some soul, then the Lord's mercy will follow the devotee's mercy. And here, I think a good example is the serpent Kaliya. As you know, Kaliya was demonic. He lived in the Jamuna River. Well, he came to the Jamuna River and completely poisoned it. And so much so that anyone who even came near it and breathed the vapors of his poison and drank the water fell unconscious, dead. So when Krishna, who was just a young boy at the time, by material calculation, saw how his cowherd boyfriends and calves had died or almost died by the poisonous influence of Kaliya Nag, he, jumped from the branch of the tree and began to wrestle with the serpent Kaliya. In the end, he danced on the serpent's hoods and gave him a great benediction. Now, Kaliya's wives, the Nagapatnis, were devotees. And they prayed to Krishna to be merciful to their husband. And because they were devotees, and because Krishna acts to fulfill the desires of his devotees, Krishna likes to please the devotees just as the devotees act to please Krishna, he accepted the prayers of the Nagapatnis, and by his mercy, by their mercy, and then by his mercy, Kaliya within himself, in spite of being so sinful and so polluted, he surrendered to Krishna and he became a devotee by the mercy of his wives who were devotees, which was followed by the mercy of the Lord. So this was the point that we discussed the other day, that when we read this verse from Bhagavad Gita, Yesham Twantikatam Papam, you know, people who have acted piously in their past lives and their present lives and are completely free from sinful actions and reactions, or beyond the duality of illusion, they can engage in devotional service. Well, that doesn't sound like us. We weren't that pure. But, so how did we become engaged in devotional service? By the mercy of Srila Prabhupada and his servants. So, alright, that's how we began, but then sometimes we begin and we falter, and we fail, and we stumble, and we fall. But even then, the devotee is not lost. His spiritual master will keep track of him and take care of him. In the case of our generation, I think it's true of all generations that Srila Prabhupada does, but in our generation, he's also our immediate spiritual master. But I think the same applies to his servants who have accepted disciples, that they keep track of us. They don't let us go. We're never lost. And there are instances of disciples of Srila Prabhupada whose devotional service seem to be interrupted. They stopped chanting, they engaged in sinful activities, illicit sex, intoxication. But later on, somehow they came back to their original consciousness. Sometimes the incident that acted to bring them back, or served as the impetus to bring them back, was a mortal illness. You know, confronted with death, with the prospect of imminent death, somehow they like came to their senses. And, you know, Srila Prabhupada manifests his mercy. These are devotees that, I mean, it's probably true of many other devotees, but maybe we heard of these devotees more because of this service they did to Srila Prabhupada earlier. And, you know, Prabhupada manifested his mercy, he entered their hearts, and devotees, you know, rallied around them and gave them support and encouragement in the last days, and brought them prasad and chanted with them. You know, one example that comes to mind is Sudama, who Goswami Maharaj spoke to at the end. And there are others. There are some who you know, impelled by the prospect of imminent death, came back to Krishna consciousness, and then they didn't die. Even our god sister, Mother Malati, such a wonderful devotee, her service seemed to be interrupted for a while, but when she discovered, you know, she had a a disease that could take her life. She came back, and I mean, she's been doing the most wonderful service for years. You know, I mean, in principle, she could die at any moment. And you know, His Holiness Radhana Swami commented, she doesn't have time to die. She's so fully engaged in devotional service, now she doesn't have time to die. She's just been going on for years. So it's practical. I remember when I first joined, I heard that Srila Prabhupada said that if you just turn one screw in the temple, you're not even really a devotee, you're just like an ordinary person who comes in and does a little service. And Srila Prabhupada said, if you just turn one screw in the temple, you know, Krishna will take note of it and he'll never let you go. So it happens. We're in the world and there's danger at every step. So it does happen that there may be a temporary disruption. But Krishna promises, and we've seen practically that Kauntiya Pratijanihi Name Bhakta Pranashati, in the end, the devotee is never lost. Hare Krishna.
Hare.
Are there any questions or comments? Chaitanya Chandra Prabhu.
I was thinking of that by nature, like for instance, Kaliya's nature as a serpent was naturally offensive in a sense. He emitted all his poison.
Mm-hmm.
So, if someone's nature is offensive, just kind of naturally, because they're whatever they are, they're just, you know, loud, or they're, you know, they just cry, they're proud by nature, and they just naturally seem to offend people. Then I was just thinking, how is that, you know, how are they going to get people beyond that? Is that, I was thinking clearly of an example, but that's an impediment also that I feel I have, at least, that, so I was just thinking, how is it, what kind of scenario would be a possibility for somebody who's just too proud somehow or other, Krishna, you know?
That's a nice question. It's true, we're all born with different natures. And even after we come to Krishna consciousness, we still have our natures. And some are more pleasing, you know, in a material sense, and some are more problematic in a material sense. But we can't just change our natures, even though we're devotees. If, you know, as devotees we shouldn't means if, you know, as we progress, we won't identify with our natures. You know, we'll see that's just the way we're constructed. Our bodies, you know, gross bodies and subtle bodies have been made in a certain way, but that's not really us. And, you know, if we're honest with ourselves and open with others, then they shouldn't take offense. You know, if we say, you know, I have a bad temper and sometimes I just fly off the handle and you know, it's just my nature, I'm trying to work on it, but it's taking time, but, you know, I don't mean any harm and I'm really sorry that you had to be the object of it, and, you know, please forgive me and don't take it personally, but it just happens, and like that, then they'll understand it's like it's your nature, but it's not that you really have any malice in your heart or that you're that you want to like destroy them or demolish them or something, you know, drive them away. So I think like that, if we're aware of our limitations and are able to speak openly about them so that people understand it's just our limitations, it's not that we have any ill will towards them or have any bad intentions towards them, then they'll take it for what it is. Yes.
I have one question regarding, once a devotee, always a devotee, is pretty much the theme of what we're hearing today. And so if we know a devotee in a certain capacity, and either we take shelter with them, or maybe they're just our friend, and then at some point, because of some impediment, they're not in that capacity that we know them as a devotee. Being in the stage that we are, how do we continue to associate with that devotee, even though they're not acting in the same capacity that they have been in the past? And how do we see them? Because if we see them in the same way, then we also can fall to whatever they have become fallen to. Let's say if it's a friend or whatever. Because of our position as well, you know, we become what we associate with. And so while that person is on a temporary break from being a devotee, we can't, it's almost like our responsibility not to see them in that capacity, but yet the paradox is that we do have to honor that at the same time. So how do we resolve that?
That's also a good question. How do we relate to a devotee who at one time has been a friend or a guide, but whose devotional service is temporarily interrupted? Well, first of all, we should always appreciate what they did for us. Burijan Prabhu tells the story of his association with Siddha Swarup, who helped Burijan. Burijan Prabhu felt he helped him. But Siddha Swarup sort of went in a certain direction that was not favorable to ISKCON. And so when Srila Prabhupada came to Hong Kong and met Burijan Prabhu there, and Siddha Swarup was active in that area, he told, you know, Burijan Prabhu explained the situation. Srila Prabhupada said that he may have helped you in the past, but he cannot help you now. And then Burijan Prabhu said, but I feel grateful to him for all the help that he gave me in the past. And Srila Prabhupada said, yeah, oh yes, should always feel grateful for help that we've received. So I think that sort of summarizes the basic principle. Now the fact, I mean, there will be, like in that particular case, Srila Prabhupada didn't want Burijan Prabhu to associate with Siddha Swarup anymore. It may be that someone, it could be true, you know, he helped you in the past, but he cannot help you now. That may be true. But it may not be the case that we should avoid his association. It really depends on what's going on. But certainly the relationship will be different, in the sense that, the interaction will be different. It's sort of like, and this is not meant to relate to any particular situation, but you know, in the father takes care of the children, or the father takes care of the wife, the husband takes care of the wife, but it may happen that the father has an accident and is no longer able to take care of the family, but rather the family members that were once taken care of by the father, they have to take care of the father. So they appreciate, he's still the father, and they appreciate what he did for them, but he can't help them in the same way, but they, from their side, may help him in a way. But there's in the case of a spiritual master, again, there are different directions. And depending on the situation, one can just sort of pray to Krishna for the spiritual master's return and wait. That's sort of in the case where the person has become weak. But in the case where the person has become offensive to Vaishnavas, or has deviated from the basic principles and become a Mayavadi, then one has to reject him. Extending it into a broader concept, what do we do when the situation of a person that we have a relationship with changes? It may not even have anything to do with them falling down or their service being interrupted, but their situation changes. Then we have to change the way we relate to them. One devotee was telling me yesterday that how Tamal Krishna Goswami dealt so nicely with disciples in different situations, like the person might have been a brahmachari, and Goswami Maharaj would have dealt with the person in a very appropriate way as a brahmachari, but then when the person got married, he would deal with the person in an appropriate way as a grihastha. So we always have to be able to make those adjustments. It can happen between husband and wife that when they marry, both are enthusiastic for Krishna consciousness, but over the years one may lose interest. So then what? Do you just get divorced, and does the less Krishna conscious one look for a less Krishna conscious spouse, and does the more Krishna conscious one look for a more Krishna conscious spouse, or do they stay together and try to sort of find a happy medium by which they can stay together and make advancement, each can make advancement, and at the same time, if the other one needs a little freedom to do other things, obviously within limits, then we sort of have, there's to be give and take. So I guess in summary, I would say we should always be grateful for the help that we received, and depending on the circumstances, not associate or associate, but then if we do associate, maybe in a different way than we used to, at least for the time being. Any other questions or comments? Chaitanya Chandra Prabhu.
Description type of Ajamiro is chanting because he cried out in helplessness. He chanted nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't offensive.
Mm-hmm.
It was in Malabas. So when we're like every day we're chanting around us, we're trying to, and sometimes we just don't feel like we're making any progress. Is that, can that be considered? I mean, obviously there's some offense. We're still offensive in our chanting, so that's what's holding us up. But I guess my question is how to somehow see it clear enough to understand what to do to try and get over that particular impediment. I mean, is it just a matter of just praying to the spiritual master of Krishna, or do we have a lot of grants that they remove it, or how do we actually kind of get across the border of the impediment that we're in?
It's a good question, Chaitanya Chandra Prabhu, that we're chanting, but the quality of the chanting is so good, not so good, and how do we improve? Well, of course, chanting. Srila Prabhupada said, practice makes perfect even in spiritual life. So you keep practicing chanting and eventually you'll become perfect. You know, once I asked Srila Prabhupada, because I felt I wasn't able to hear attentively when I chanted. So he said, chant loudly. He gave the same instruction to other disciples. One of our god brothers in Bombay, Panchatravida Swami, later, at the time Brahmachari, he asked the same question. Prabhupada said, chant loudly. So he said, well, I go out to the city all day, I walk on the street and I meet people, or I'm in the bus, and if I chant loudly, people will become disturbed. I said, oh, don't worry about that, they won't mind. And so he just started to chant loudly. He said once he was in an elevator and he was really chanting loudly, and it's also if he has a positive attitude, if he doesn't feel ashamed or embarrassed, then the other people will see it positively. Like the story Prabhupada told of maybe the Charlie Chaplin movie, where he sat down on a, he was at a formal ball, and he sat down on a chair that had wet paint or glue or something on it. So when he got up, the tails to his tuxedo ripped all the way up the back. So instead of feeling embarrassed or mortified, he went on the dance floor and he started dancing with more enthusiasm and more exuberance. And everyone started to think, wow, he's like the star of the show. And then they saw that his coattails were ripped up the back. And they thought, oh, that must be the new fashion. So they all started ripping their coattails. So Prabhupada told that story to the three couples who first went to England. And he said, if you're very enthusiastic, then people will they'll want to follow what you're doing. So I think it's like that. If we chant loudly and then we start looking around very nervous, did somebody hear me? It's like, then they'll look at you ooh, what's with you? But if you're, that's what I think happened to Panchatravida. It was so positive. I got the order from Prabhupada and chanting loudly. And, I can imagine him looking around and smiling and everyone smiling and getting into it. So that's, I think, been a common instruction to chant loudly. And then, of course, you know, things we know. Get up early in the morning, chanting earlier is better. Brahma Muhurta. Chanting in front of the deities, chanting in front of Tulsi Devi, where the atmosphere is more spiritual, that helps. Chanting in the association of devotees who have taste, that helps a lot. Even japa can help a lot, to just chant near someone who has taste during japa. And just, you know, not to be in a place where there's a lot of distractions. They can be physical distractions, or like if you chant in your office where you do your work, then you're going to think of all of the work you have to do. So some place where there's no sensory or mental distractions, be easier. But whatever it is, we just have to keep at it. Yes?
You almost asked a question I was thinking of, that, you know, Ajahn Lahee and Noi Chan offense asleep about the holy name. And devotees are constantly making themselves aware of the offenses in the day to day, trying to pray and to be free from offending the holy name. Is it that somebody who has no knowledge or understanding of Krishna whatsoever, if they just chant the name, is it more apt that they're chanting offensively, even though they're committing all sorts of sinful activities? And I have a quandary about how is it possible that the lifestyle he was leading, and it was against, you know, these spiritual master's instructions. It seems like everything would be against his ability to be able to chant free from offense.
Mm-hmm. Asking about Ajamil. You know, while he chanted offensively, is it better just to be ignorant and then you won't commit offenses? Well, no, it's not. And I should mention here that in the commentaries on the story of Ajamil, in Srila Prabhupada's edition, I believe he quotes Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, that because Ajamil had engaged in devotional service in his childhood and youth, when he chanted the holy name of Narayan to indicate his son, the chanting invoked his previous consciousness from his earlier devotional service. And so we come back to the point that whatever advancement one makes is not lost. It may be in African chant with the Africans. I mean, they loved the chanting. They loved to chant and dance. And many times, especially when we went to the homelands where we were going for the first time or where we didn't regularly go, they wouldn't want to stop chanting. You know, our devotees would, you know, slave, I'm tired, you know, I'm hungry, let's go back. And the Africans, they just wanted to keep chanting, and you know, they could have gone all night. And I actually thought that it's because they haven't committed any offenses. You know, they're completely innocent. They haven't committed any offenses. And therefore, they have so much enthusiasm and taste that they're ready to keep going. So I think there is some truth to that. But the difficulty is that when we leave the township, they won't chant anymore. You know, they might a little now and then, but they won't systematically. So that's the advantage to knowledge, that although, you know, when you get into it, there is room to commit offenses, but when you get into it, you have the knowledge that will inspire you to continue your efforts. Whereas people who are ignorant, at the moment, they may be very ecstatic in their chanting, But because they don't have the knowledge, they won't continue. So that's the problem there. Okay, I'm just going to add a few words here because one of the devotees asked me to speak about Diwali. Maybe it's my rebellious nature, but I didn't like the idea that I have to speak about Diwali. So I'm going to tell a little story that indirectly relates to Diwali. And I'm not the only one. Even like years ago, I sort of had a talk with Satsvarupa Maharaj, and he would say, like sometimes people say, you know, not that it's wrong, but, you know, they would say, oh, can you tell us a story about Srila Prabhupada? And he said, anyway, that could just be that we both have the same weakness. But one year, this is Ram Navami. Now, of course, Diwali celebrates the return of Ram to Ayodhya after his exile in the forest, and Sita was kidnapped by Ravana. So then Ram and Lakshman and their army of monkeys and bears and squirrels, they Ram floated boulders on the ocean, and they crossed over to Lanka, and they met Ravana and his army in combat, and in the end Ram killed Ravana. And the festival that celebrates the killing of Ravana by Ram is called Ram Vijay Dasami, or Dasara. Then Sita returned, and then there was the whole question, you know, that she had spent the night out of the care of her husband with Ravana, and whether she was fit to be taken back. And then she was placed in the fire, and she emerged and was considered to be pure. And then Sita and Ram and their associates, Lakshman and their associates, returned to Ayodhya. So to celebrate their return, the part of the greeting was at the residence of Ayodhya lit lamps and put out lamps to receive Lord Ram. And in the Vaishnav Toshini commentary on the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Sanatana Goswami quotes that the pastime of Lord, of Mother Yasoda binding Lord Krishna with ropes, that took place on the Diwali day. So, anyway, the little story, I guess, so this was on Ram Navami. So in the morning, well, there was one Gujarati devotee in Bombay, Manasvi. So after the morning program, he announced that, it's Ram Navami, and in the evening we'll be having Ram Dune. Dune is like Kirtan. Kirtan. So afterwards, Prabhupada, sort of chastised him that, why Ram do? We're chanting Hare Krishna, everything's included in Hare Krishna. What's this Ram do? And then in the evening, from the Vyasa San, Srila Prabhupada, said today is Ram Navami, and then he started to explain how all the incarnations are included in Krishna, including Ram. And
I mean, he made one statement like so powerful from the Vyasa-san, you know, we know who Ram is better than anyone. You know, we love Lord Ram. But still, he's included in Krishna, and we don't need to discuss him separately. And then he gave Bhagavad Gita class. And of course, sometimes he did speak on Ram Navami and other occasions, so it's sort of like time, place, and circumstance. But anyway, it's a great festival, Hindu festival. And it's also the new year in Hindu tradition. I mean, there are many new years in India. There's South Indian New Year. I mean, there are so many new years, but Diwali is one of the new years. And we have ours with Gaur Purnima, so, but it's always good to welcome a new year, to maybe make some good resolutions for the year to come, traditionally, Hindus try to liquidate their debts by Diwali. They don't want to carry their debts into the new year. Which reminds me, I owe you $300 from Sarvakanti. So liquidate our debts, rectify our relationships, and enter the new year, you know, with resolution, with a resolute determination to improve in Krishna consciousness. So, Happy New Year. Shiva Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jai Gaur Premanandi. Gaur Bhaktavinda Ki Jai. Shiva Gurudev Ki Jai.